This is the session 6:50 on life living in South Africa. And one of the great things about this place is that I know there's one fellow South African here. I don't know where he is, but he's somewhere here. Oh, there he is. It's somewhere in the back. And there's a young man who is working, who's part of the staff here, who is also from Namibia. So I'm not alone here. If you remember those who were here last night when we had the Eucharist, we talked and read somewhere, I know I was one of the readers, about Moses taking some of the elders of Israel on top of the mountain and they saw God. And earlier this morning we talked about every one of us has a song, and we shouldn't lose our song of life. And if we lose the song, the music stops and life stops. And what we're trying to do tonight is to... Is there an echo? Is it my ears? What we're trying to do tonight is to put a human face into what's happening in South Africa. I don't know how to do that, except by telling you about myself and about my family and about my own experiences of growing up. I don't do that because I am in any way special or I come from some amazing family. But what I'm trying to do is to make you get the feeling of what it is like to live under apartheid in South Africa. There will be four sessions or more, they tell me, that will be dealing with South Africa. Tomorrow we'll have one on history, so you can get the history of what it's like. How did we come up to the point where we are? One of my favorite lines is that, if you can imagine, and I know sometimes Christians get sensitive about this, but if you can imagine that God ever played a joke on any part of the world, I believe it was South Africa, because black and white people in South Africa are doomed to be together. We may hate each other, we may kill each other, but we are stuck together. And you know, so it's one of those very interesting situations. When we talk about South Africa, when we talk about South Africa, we are really talking about a huge country. You know, the United States State Department has a way of describing it. And those who study geography will see and remember that people who study geography think so different from us. In fact, it borders off being a little bit crazy. They say that the geographers who work for the State Department say South Africa is the size of, now this is where the fun starts, is the size of Texas, Arizona, California, Wisconsin, and Oregon combined. So you can try and figure that one out. And I told you it gets difficult, but this is it, folks. And you know, so that's how big South Africa is. And when we talk about South Africa, really, we're not talking about the laws and what have you. That, we're going to have a session on that. But we're talking about people. And the people in South Africa, they are white, they are black, they are so-called colored, they are Indian, and everybody else. There are 30 million South Africans. Now, one of the things I get as I go around the country, people say, why South Africa? Why not any other country? Why? What have you got against South Africa? Well, the reason we talk about South Africa is that this is the only country in the world today. If you took the globe and flip it, and this is the only country in the world that practices legalized and institutionalized racism. Now, there's racism in the United States, there's racism in the Soviet Union, there's racism in China, there's racism in Africa, there's racism elsewhere. The difference about South Africa is that racism is mandated and required by law. If there's one thing you learn from tonight's talk, is to remember that under South African laws, it is illegal not to be a racist. John Dugard, who is a law professor in South Africa, did a book, which is a little small book, where he demonstrated that if you took all the laws of South Africa and you stood up and said, I am not a racist, you have committed a crime, because the law requires that you be a racist. There are 317 laws that we call the pillars of apartheid. And I won't go through all 317, but just to give you an idea, but before I give you the idea of the laws, let's fit in the people. See, this is going to be a puzzle. We're going to fit in the people somewhere, because really it's about people. One of these key pillars is called the Race Classification Act. Now, in South Africa, all the laws say exactly what they mean. They don't hide around, you know, they don't. Race Classification Act simply says people must be classified according to race. So it's very, and the action of doing that is called an act. So the Race Classification Act says every individual in South Africa must be classified according to race or skin complexion. If you start doing that, we come in all shades and complexion. So what they did to make sure that we fall into the right color category, they created what is known as a race classification board, just like a board of water affairs and board of education. And and the most interesting thing about the board is that all over the country it's made up of three old white men. And this is the incredible thing about, in fact, if you ever read James Michener's book, The Covenant, which is about the Afrikaners, and you stay with it for 700 pages, somewhere there in the back, he actually writes a lot about the Race Classification Board. And it's usually three old white men who are retired from the government or have been farmers. And their job is to take a look at you and decide where you fall in. And so I'll just give you the categories so you know what we're talking about. At the top, we have the whites in South Africa. Now, we have a saying in South Africa that if you're white, you better be white. You can't afford to go to the beach and come back with a deeper tan. You might fall into the next category. So you better be white. And remember that this is a legal definition. See, it's not just a matter of, I stayed indoors for 6 days and I'm a little bit lighter. It's a legal definition. There's a case, and I give you two cases. One is a recent case about a year ago. And again, you have to remember now, when I say white, it's because you have to paint people in those ways to understand. A white South African housewife was going out in the morning to throw out garbage. And next to the garbage can, she found a newly born baby that had been abandoned, just like babies are abandoned in New York or in Minneapolis or wherever. Being a white South African housewife, she called a hospital for whites and said, there's a baby here. They sent an ambulance for whites. They came and picked up the baby. But you see, the law says the midwife or the doctor that delivers the baby must classify immediately the newborn baby by race, because that's a matter of the law. But you see, the baby was found next to the garbage can. They couldn't tell who the mother was. And babies tend to look alike after 1 day or 2 days and whatever. So what the doctors at the hospital did, they did what was the best thing to do. They quarantined the baby and waited for the baby to change color. But it was like God was playing a joke on them. The baby wouldn't change quick enough. And the reason the story was reported in the papers was because the South African Parliament, which is like the Congress here, spent half a day discussing the fate of this baby. Where do we fit this baby? And when the newspapers started reporting about it, and they realized that the world was laughing at them for what they were doing, they decided that that story was national security, nobody could write about it. So I can't tell you what happened to the fate of that baby. And another case, which is, you may want to get a videotape of it, there's a program that's like 60 Minutes with the BBC. They did a story of a young white woman who, when she reached a teenage years, her skin started darkening, like you've seen people come back from the beach. And other children in school started saying, hey, your skin is no longer white. and they complained to the local police. This young lady was arrested, brought before the police, who brought her before the Race Classification Board, which ruled that even though her parents were white, they could trace their ancestry to Europe, she had ceased to be a white person because her skin had darkened. And I'm giving you just those two examples to say to you, it's a serious matter because it's a matter of the law. There are 4.5 million white South Africans. The next color category are people who are called colored. Now, I know from reading in this country that black people used to be called colored not too long ago. And, you know, but in South Africa, it's a legal definition. That means those of mixed parentage, either not too dark enough or not too light enough. I have a friend who lives in Washington, D.C. He's got blonde hair, blue eyes, but he's not light enough to qualify for white. The problem, of course, was that at night, under neon lights, he looked white. During the day, he looks a little bit darker, and, you know, so he was classified colored. During the day, he rides colored buses. At night, when he tries to ride colored buses, they send him to white buses. And during the day, when he tries to ride white buses, they send him to colored buses. That's why he lives in Washington, D.C. There are 2 million such colored people. The next category of people are Indians. And if you remember watching the movie Gandhi, you'll remember that Mahatma Gandhi started and brought his peaceful resistance in South Africa. And there are 800,000 East Indians simply because by law, they are not allowed to be joined by families. And in some cases, people, because of their religious faith, they get married to people of their faith in India, and they have to conduct their marriages across the Indian Ocean. Then there's us African people, there are 22 million of us. Well, it's very interesting. We don't have time tonight, but I do this to give you an idea of what it's like to live. You know, I left South Africa when I was well over 30 years old, and the only time there had been a census was once when I was 6 years old. And like whenever there's a census in this country, there were stories that any family with more than two children, any black family, would be sent away to the rural homelands where there's hunger, disease, and whatever. And I wasn't sure what my mother was believing in these stories. But on the day the census came, a white man came, an Afrikaner man, and with a black interpreter, and asked my mother, there were four of us at the time, asked my mother, how many people sleep here? You see, you have to understand language. Language is very important. In South Africa, the government says black people don't belong anywhere. We only sleep in some areas where they allow us to sleep. So they never ask you, where do you live? They ask you, where do you sleep? Because, you know, you are there by their grace. Forget the grace of God, but this is the grace of the Afrikaners. And, you know, so they came to my mother and said, how many people sleep here? My mother just very calmly said, oh, it's my husband and Dumisani over there. And I thought my mother had forgotten my brother and two sisters. And I was about to open my mouth and say, but my mother gave me that motherly look. You know, the look that mothers give? And, you know, she gave me that motherly look, and I knew if I didn't want to have my butt beaten flat, I had to keep quiet. And, you know, so in my home, they counted one child and two adults. But next door, we had a neighbor who didn't have any children. But she had heard a rumor that if you had more than 10 children, you get free transportation back home. So when they came to her house, she said, I have 12 children. So they wrote 12 next door when she didn't have any. And, you know, so I'm saying those examples to show you that they say there are 22 million of us. I still want them to see count all 22 million. And, you know, but it's accepted there are 22 million of us. Then, of course, there are the Japanese and the Chinese. And the Race Classification Board was bothered by the fact they couldn't tell the difference between the Japanese and the Chinese. So they brought in a Japanese person and a Chinese person, took a look at them. In a landmark ruling, they ruled that they discovered that the Japanese had a darker skin complexion than the Chinese. However, and this is why we talk about economic sanctions, however, because the Japanese have Suzuki's, Toyota's, Mazda's, Sony's, and all those good things in our homes, they were declared honorary white South Africans. And the Chinese, because they didn't have Toyotas, were declared non-whites. Then the next categories are people who are classified other colored. And if you saw a colored and an other colored, you'd never be able to tell the difference, but they do. Then there are Malays. There's a difference between a Malay and other colored and a colored. Then there are other Malays. Then there are people they can't fit anyway who are just called others. And you know, as I said this morning, if you read a South African newspaper for a week, you'll discover they always have these little boxes about two whites were reclassified colors, two others were became other colors, and you know, but they do that all the time. And essentially all these people are broken down into four groups. If you went to South Africa, there are four distinct neighborhoods in every town. One for people they call colored, which includes other colored, Arabs and everybody else. Then the Asians, who are really the East Indians, then the Africans, and then the whites. And you know, and now, you remember I mentioned the pillars that make up apartheid, the 300 laws that make up apartheid. For instance, the Factories Act, which has to deal with factories. The Factories Act says if you open up a factory to make, say, socks, and you hire more than 10 people, you must build four bathrooms, one for whites, one for colors, one for Indians. And you know, so if you have a school, well, the schools are segregated. I mean, there's a school for Africans, colors, Indians. So everything is done into four. If there were buses running between here and Seattle, there would be four buses on the freeway, one for whites. It's same thing happens in the churches. I mean, there's a Catholic church for colors, for Indians, and you know, it's everything becomes segregated in that way. So it's possible to go to South Africa and live among black people and just think, wow, isn't it wonderful? Because everybody's in restricted to that neighborhood. Or you can go live among white people and say, wow, isn't it wonderful? Because it's done in this way. One writer wrote about Johannesburg Station. I mean, this is a station where, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people are brought in by trains. Even the trains in South Africa are segregated. You know, four cars are for whites, car for coloreds, Indians, and Africans. Everything is in four. And this man who wrote for the Washington Post was in Johannesburg. And he said he woke up in the morning, and you see Johannesburg Station drags through two blocks, two large blocks. On the one end, which is the front of the train, are whites. On the other end, the back of the train, are black people. He went to the front end, and he says on a working day, he sees these white people who come out of the subway, all dressed in their suits. They are no black people. And he said, for a moment, I thought, my God, they wiped out all black people. There aren't any at all. Until he asked and said, what happened to white people? They said, okay, walk down the block. And he walked down the block, and there were thousands of black people coming out. There were no white people. But that's just a way of trying to show you what happens. One of the questions I get asked, and we will talk about it under history tomorrow, and people always say, how come? How did they come up with this policy? I mean, how do they sit down and say, we work these people? The only thing I can give, really, is that there are two things. One, they say that it's justified biblically. Those who saw Eyes on the Prize, I watched it one night, and there was this preacher in Mississippi on the Citizens Council was thumping his Bible and saying, it's God's will that, you know, black people are. It's the same thing in South Africa, they do that. The other thing which is logical is that during World War II, and a number of historians are writing this, the strongest Nazi support outside of Germany came out of South Africa. By who? The same people who are in power. Some of them were locked up. And you know, Piet Mayer, who's always been my favorite, he gave us segregated TV. Even TV is segregated in South Africa. That there's a channel for whites only, and there are two channels for blacks only. And you know, so they managed to legally break down everything. Very quickly, how does one live under this? The only way I know how to say that, and believe me, I've tried many ways to try and explain it, is to tell you about myself, my family. Not because I am extraordinary, but because it's a way of making you understand what it's like. I mean, I was born in Northern Zululand, and my father was a migrant worker, and if you're a migrant worker, there's a law called the Migrants Act. You see, everything is just very simple and straightforward. The Migrants Act says if you're a migrant, you are by law required to give up your family. You're not allowed to see your family except once a year, even then for no more than 30 days. So you can only go back home once a year. It doesn't matter whether your child dies or your spouse dies or somebody's sick, you can't go home. You stay away in the cities working in the white cities and you see your family once a year. So in practical terms, my sister was born in 36, another in 37, another in 38, another in 40, 41, 42, because my father came home once a year. So we all have this one day every year. And you know, so when my parents were married 6 years, and my mother had six children to prove it. And you know, and two of those children were born and buried without my father ever seeing them, because they were born during the 11, 12 months when he was not home. So twice he came home to be shown the mound where his children lies. And it happens to thousands and thousands of other fathers up to this day. When my parents were married 10 years, they had been together only for a period of 6 months. Because for 4 years it was World War II, and you know, there were no trains that went back to the area where my father was. That's when my mother decided enough was enough. And you know, so she decided she was going to leave Blood River, where I was born in Zululand, and go find my father. But you see, under the Migrants Act, it is illegal for women. Now, let me say this. Black women under law are classified as, quote, and this is the phrase in the law, perpetual minors. And you know, anything a child can't do, a black woman can't do. There's a resource I bought, there's only 18 of them. It's written by black women in South Africa. It's a woman's place is in the struggle, not behind bars. And it's women who write about what it's like to be a mother, a sister, under apartheid, and they write themselves. And we only have 19, and they're $3 each. If you want them, put your name down and give me your address, and I'll send you a copy. But anyway, my mother, in short, decided to go to Johannesburg to see my father. She got arrested on the way. And it happens every morning that in those who've been to South Africa, there's a train that runs between Durban and Johannesburg. And for the areas of northern Zululand, the halfway station is Glencore. Every morning the train stops. And this is true of trains that go out into the area. The cars that carry whites and colored stop where there's a platform. The cars that carry African people stop where there is no platform. You know why? So that we can't get out of the train quickly. We have to wait for them to drop the stairs. And the reason they do that is so that they can come, drop the stairs, and check everybody who's coming out to see if they have a permit to go into the city. My mother didn't have a permit, they put her in jail. But you see, they never knew my mother. And you know, after they released and sent her back, she took the next available train, they put her in jail, then she took the next available train, they put her in jail, and eventually they said, we're tired of you, woman. And you know, and she said, I was so happy when they said that, because I was tired of them. And, you know, so they sent her into internal exile. And I know my conservative friends always talk about, you know, you want South Africa to be worse and anything. The only other country that practices internal exile is the Soviet Union. And you know, we all were writing and screaming about Sakharov, right? Remember? And you know, South Africa practices on black people, nobody talks about it. It's still happening up to today. And anyway, you know, God works in mysterious ways. Because my mother was sent into internal exile, she ended up in a place which just happened to be close enough for my father to come home every night or every other week. So in the first 10 years, after, on the 11th year of their marriage, my parents started learning how to live together as husband and wife. And some days it wasn't easy. Another quick thing I just want to say to you. You remember the infant formula thing? Well, it happened to my mother that all the children who were born in Everton, where I grew up, died in their infancy. And you know, and we couldn't figure this out. And one day she had run out of money of doctors, so she decided she was going to, she heard in the village there was this man who laid hands and was praying for the sick. So my sister, who's now 30 odd years, and she was a baby, and because my mother had broad shoulders, she couldn't carry my sister on her back, so they tied her on me. And we went to this man, and who was a healer, and we laid these bones down in front of him, a really skeleton of a baby, who was about to die. And this man said, woman, what's wrong with this child? Well, you know, this is the fifth child, four have died in the infancy. And this man, old man, turned around and said, when last did you breastfeed this baby? My mother said, I never breastfed the baby. But you see what happened, each time my mother gave birth, the law says the doctor must be there, even if the doctor comes afterwards to see the baby and register the baby, or the midwife. When they come, they give you a tin of fluctogen or SMA, and you know, and the instructions on the tin are in English. There's nothing wrong with the infant formula, but the tin is in English. My mother can't read English. She was taught to read and write by Episcopalians who use the Bible as a textbook, and a Zulu Bible for that matter. And you know, so she couldn't read the instructions. So she had to remember what the nurse said. But you see, the nurse says, boil the water, mix 1 spoon of infant formula. Hell, we only had fire once a day, so we only boil water in the morning. They never said you have to boil it at 12 when you feed the baby again. So water is boiled once a day. And they didn't say if my father's payday was a week away, what do you do about infant formula? So my mother used to try and stretch the infant formula. She didn't reduce the level of the water, so instead of 2 spoons, it's 1 spoon. Eventually, it's half a teaspoon, and the water is the same. So you see why little babies in the so-called third world have extended bodies. And when we said we ran a campaign on infant formula, middle-class mothers in the Western world say, what's wrong with infant? I brought up my children on it. Hell, you know, you can read the instructions, they're in English. And you know, when my mother started breastfeeding my sister, like I say, she's a mother too now, and you know, she lives. And you know, I'm just throwing that again to show you how it works. I became a journalist by accident. You see, I grew up at a time when the most beautiful woman I knew was my mother. The strongest man I knew was my father. My parents were my heroes. I can't tell you the pain of seeing these heroes of mine being reduced to nothing by police who could come in storming at any hour. There are 5,000 children in jail in South Africa today. And you know, you ask yourself, why 10-year-olds throw stones? You know why? It's because you see the only hero, the only protector you have being rendered worthless and powerless in front of your eyes. You try and do something. If you remember reading about the West Bank, you know, in the occupied areas, and you know, they said, they were interviewing and saying, why do these Palestinian children throw stones? Why can't they be nice like their parents? But you know, it's they see their parents, you know, have been rendered worthless every day, and they throw stones, and you say, we can't understand why these children do this. It's because if they take away your song, as we said this morning, or if they take away your hero, and you know, what else do you have left? Can you, it's very hard to comprehend, I guess, in the United States, imagining you could come home and your 10-year-old child is missing, and you never are told where they are, or you come home and you see your parent, you know, being rendered useless. People say to me, why can't you go to Ronald Reagan, who has an ability to make statements that confuse me at least, and once said, if they do this to you, you must go lay charges against them. Terrific, right? Yeah, you lay charges against them. Well, the reason I became a journalist was because I thought I could ask the questions in the right places, and that's why I'm sitting here in Holden today, ask too many questions. And but again, I just want to give you a couple of stories which give you the flavor of what it's like to live in South Africa. You know, even up to this very day, if two cars are driving on the freeway, one is driven by black motorists, one by white motorists, they get involved in an accident, you call two ambulances, one for blacks and one for whites. It happens today. I mean, a friend of mine who's still editing a paper or staying with me, and he says, it's such a common story, we no longer even bother writing about it. I mean, it happens this very day. And you know, I got married on December 4, 1970. And those who are married, and I know we have a couple of videotapes, Bishop, got yours, yeah? About marriage and what have you. Well, on January 3, 1971, I got arrested for sleeping with my wife without government permission. And I know when I tell people, they say, how come I never knew that? I saw Bishop Tutu tell a reporter, and they looked at him as if he's crazy. But you see, the law says in South Africa, if you are born in one town and you marry someone in the next town, you may stay married, but you may not live together as husband and wife without government permission. So what do you think we do? We think if you're attracted to somebody, you ask them their zip code first? No, we don't do that. And you know, so we go right ahead and make your move, as they say in Brooklyn. and just live and you know, take a chance. And you know. And I took a chance, and unfortunately I was writing for the newspaper, And, you know, they didn't like what I was writing, so I got arrested. And I can't, when my case got covered, by the way, if you want the newspaper clip so you can read for yourself, and, you know, I can give them to the bishop here and he can circulate them around. But when we had this huge trial, I was working for a newspaper which has since closed, called the Golden City Post, and my editors said, and they were British, they said, well, let's go to court, you know, just like Americans love to say, let's go to court, you know, as if the scales are even in court, right? And, you know, so we went to court, and we got publicity. I can't tell you young couples, older couples who came to us and said, we pray for you to win, because if you lose, we'll be in trouble. I want to leave you with one story of a young couple, John and Pauline Musia. You've heard of Soweto. Soweto is an acronym for Southwestern Township. So Soweto is on the southwestern end of Johannesburg. And on the northwestern end is another township called Alexandra. The distance between Soweto and Alexandra is about 5 miles at the very most. It's like downtown and uptown. John was born in Alexandra. Pauline was born in Soweto, separated by 5 miles in the same city. They were not allowed to live together as husband and wife. Pauline lived in a women's hostel, single-sex hostel, and they had a two-year-old girl. And they met at train stations and bus stations. And when they heard about our trial, they came and said, oh, please, we hope you win. Excuse me, I was worried because I knew we were going to lose. And we lost. Pauline was so devastated. She went home, took a plastic bag, tied it around her daughter's two-year-old neck, held it until the poor kid died. Then she took a rope, she hanged herself. But before she hanged herself, she wrote a note. She said, you know, the preacher who married us said, whatever God put together, let no man put asunder. She said, I'm being denied the most fundamental right to live with a husband I love. It's happening today. In fact, if you want, there's an organization of white South African women. You know, there are white South Africans who are opposed to apartheid, who have done things. There's an organization of white South African women called the Black Sash. And they spend a bulk of their time documenting, trying to help people who are separated by those laws. And, you know, they are in the process of helping, and they publish so you can read about it. Well, what do we do about this? I mean, these are just some of the things. And, you know, what do we do about this? Well, one of the things we'll be talking about later on is, again, you probably heard me talk about it, and I'll harp on it again, has been sanctions. And I just want to end up with sanctions and go through some of the questions that people throw. People say to me genuinely, and I don't doubt their genuineness on this, people say to me, well, we don't want to do anything about sanctions because it will hurt black people. Hell, some of the things I've just told you, I mean, those are pains we suffer from apartheid. And, you know, it can't be worse than it is, except if they build gas ovens. I mean, that's as far as you can go. And, you know, and I get very worried about people who love black people only when they are 10,000 miles away. We don't love them when they're in our congregation. We don't love them in our own city. We wait until they're 10,000 miles away. I mean, why should anybody take that seriously? And, you know, then people say, and it's a big thing in this country, well, but, you know, companies provide jobs. As I said this morning, slavery was a full employment opportunity. The slaves work. And so it doesn't mean that if you have a job, you become oppressed less or more humanely than somebody without a job. You're oppressed because you're not white. That's simple. That's what the laws say. And, you know, people say, well, my conservative friends like this one, say, what you need to do is create more jobs, pump in more money, right? In 1960, United States investment in South Africa was $40 million. In 1985, it was $18 billion. So you can see it went from $40 million to $18 billion. And, you know, the repression in those 25 years increased tremendously. The Lutheran Church, our church, when we ask them to divest their pension funds, they say to us they are bound by fiduciary responsibility. In other words, invest pension funds in a profitable way. Okay, So why don't we put money in cocaine, where we could make more money? Why don't we put money in pornography, where we could make more? 42nd Street in New York, you can make a lot of money. And you know, then they turn around and say, oh, we can't invest in that. So why do we invest in racism? I don't understand. I mean, if cocaine and pornography are objectionable, how come racism isn't? And you know, and the tragedy is that there are alternative investments that meet the law of the United States, that are prudent as required by law, that have nothing to do with South Africa. There is more than $50 billion that has been divested in the last 5 years. Nobody has lost a penny. And you know, it's the city of New York where I live. And you know, they made $300 million divested. The state of Connecticut suddenly had more money for what they call middle income housing because of divestment. So we're not asking the Lutheran Church to take a step that is extraordinary and jeopardize the bishop's pension and you know, and all the other folks. And you know, we're simply saying there are things we can do. We can't stand with racism. Because if we benefit from racism in South Africa, how can we talk like tonight about the multicultural church? How are people going to believe us? And I left the church in South Africa because I couldn't understand why, you know, the bishops would turn around and say, you know, it's the government and, you know, we are saving your soul for heaven. And, you know, and I think Elmer Witt said, you know, for some of us it's whoop-de-doo, we're going to heaven. And, you know, but, you know, it's questions like that. What we are trying to do this week is not to try and change your mind in anything, but rather start asking questions. And you know, ask the questions in an indirect way. So, I mean, these are some of the things that I said, but I just want you to know that I tell you about what it's like to live in South Africa, in my case, not because it's extraordinary, but to show you that when we talk about apartheid, we don't mean the fact that we can't vote. Hell, you know, there are days when I would forget the thing about voting. What more could you wish for than to live with your spouse in peace? I mean, you know, who cares about voting? And you know, it's the little things that people enjoy that are human around the world that we value. Rather than, oh, you know, let them just open the schools and, you know, let them read in the same, let them ride the same bus, let them sit at the same counter. I mean, that's okay, but what we call denial of our being is much deeper than what the few laws can change. So when people say apartheid can be reformed, it's like saying you can change the taste of a rotten cake by putting vanilla ice cream on it. All it does, it makes it a sweet rotten cake. You know, you have to change the ingredients to get to the sauce. Well, why don't I stop here? And you know, because this is supposed to be a discussion, I give you 2.5 seconds to say something about it.
in the context of questions,
okay. Because the bishop has been involved with the church and talking about these issues, so I wanted him to be here. But anyway, this is about trying to put faces, and please feel free to ask questions or to comment. And if I can't ask the question, there's another fellow South African, he'll help me, yes.
What is the status of the statement on the back of the white sheet?
Okay, I gave you a white sheet which has the voices from Namibia. Some people you might recognize, some you may not.
It talks about the name being the possible name.
Okay, yes, this has gone further, of course, because of the Democratic convention that they had. The bill is still alive in the House. I before I came here, they told us in Washington, people like the Washington office on Africa now, that the bill will come out of the House. It's not sure whether the Senate would act. So what they were asking is to simply pressure the US senators, which makes it easy because it's just two people. And you don't have to write a legible letter or some really creative. It's simply to say, we want you to endorse the sanctions bill that's before Parliament. The bill includes a part on Namibia that South Africa has to get out of Namibia as well.
Thank you.
For those folks up there, just speak up because I might miss you in peanut alley. So, yeah.
What happens if a black person tries to marry a white person?
Oh, good. I'm glad you asked. There's a law called, again, ta-da, Group Areas Act. Again, it says group because all groups have must their way. What they did, because of the pressure in this country, they repealed what was known as the Mixed Marriages Act. And you know, so they repealed the Mixed Marriages Act and say blacks and whites can get married. But because they haven't repealed the Group Areas Act, it means that these people from different groups stay married, but they can't live together. Because there is no new group where people of in a multicultural sense can live together. And you know, so there are cases now, in fact, I think one young man or woman, I think was a Lutheran missionary in South Africa. And she married a black man. I think it's a young woman from this country, a member of the Lutheran church, married a black man. And they are having a terrible time because they can't live anywhere. And you see, that becomes a problem in that the Group Areas Act is still there. So, you know, on one hand, they point, we repeal this, but when you look at the other pillar, they still can't do anything. And when they asked the minister and said, what happens if they go on a honeymoon, you know, and because the trains are segregated. And he said, if they ask for special permission in advance, we will have a spot in the cafeteria where they can live together, but they will have to occupy separate compartments. So it's still back to square one. Anyone else? Just speak up in case I miss you.
I have a question.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
How long is this, I know it's getting more rigid all the time, but how long has this been going on?
This has been going, well, it's been going on forever. But apartheid as the legalization of what we call apartheid today began in 1948. However, as you will see in the history tomorrow, and Melissa here will be talking about the history of South Africa, it goes way back. I mean, to me, the real issue started in 1913 when they passed the Land Act. It is illegal for a black person in South Africa to own property. Did you know that? It is illegal. And you know, so it's the 1913 Land Act said black people can't own any land. You can occupy 13% of the land by permission of the government. And you know, so by 1948, they really were just fine-tuning a policy that goes even way back. I mean, you can go past 1913. You can go back to 1886 when they claimed they discovered gold. And in fact, when all they did, the Sotho people who were mining gold were driven away from their lands, the Xhosa people in the Cape were driven away from their diamond mines, and they took them over and said, we discovered, just like Columbus, you know, he came here, found Native Americans, and said, hey, I discovered the place, and the same story. So tomorrow when we get into the history, you can begin to see how they've gone around. Finally, yes, ma'am.
It seems like you have to change these laws, and you said that you're not concerned about voting. Wouldn't that be if you could vote and vote your own people and make some changes in these ridiculous laws?
Okay. Let me answer you in a wider way. This is not a question you asked, but it's going to answer. People in the United States, this country has had one government for 12 years, 11 years? But there's been one government. Yes. We have Republicans and Democrats, but some days it's one and the same thing. And you know, but the essentially there's been one government. If you don't like anything in this government, you either vote them out or you put so much pressure or you wait them out like we are waiting out Reagan until January. I can't wait. And but you can wait them out and they leave and but the trouble in South Africa is that legally, the South African Constitution, see, the United States Constitution says all men were created equal. Forgot women, you know, but it's all men were created equal. And so that becomes the benchmark. We can go to court and argue constitutionally. I am denied the rights because the Civil Rights Act of 1964 says these rights are promised. the South African Constitution says there's only 4.5 million citizens. They are white. So you see, I can't bring a class action suit. Have you ever wondered how come black people have never sued for discrimination? We can't sue because we don't exist legally. If you went to Canada across the fence here, you can't sue Canada because they deny, right? Because you're not Canadian, right? Legally, 26 million people in South Africa don't exist legally. We don't exist. We are not citizens. So, you know, we can't change any laws in that way. So that's what I meant by saying, if we have to change any laws, the Constitution has to recognize that we are there. So in South Africa, we're not, I hate to compare one misery to another. But if you can allow me to draw comparisons between the civil rights struggle and what's happening in South Africa, you could say that the states of Mississippi, Georgia, and whatever, were denying black people rights that were promised in the Constitution. And I hear that if in fact you had money and had great lawyers, you could spend years going to the Supreme Court to try and reverse some of those things. So the rights were promised there, but Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama and all of them were saying, no, we can't allow you that right. In South Africa, we don't exist. I mean, it's not a question of we denied rights. We don't, legally, we don't. The South African Constitution says there are 4.5 million citizens and they are all white, period. And you know, so we have to start at square one and be recognized as we exist. Then we can then talk about what kind of country we're building. And you know, so that's the biggest problem you have. And you know, it's that's at the heart of what apartheid is. Does that, yes?
What do you see the scenario that, assuming that investments no longer allow,
right,
and it now gets to the point, but what's the next scenario? What's the next
question? Okay. Well, let me tell you what people have said. Again, I'm just jumping ahead to the questions the way they've been answered. It's been said that if you have complete divestment, there will be violence because people won't have jobs, they will be starving. There's violence in South Africa already. It's just that whites are killing blacks, and that's called law and order. If whites kill blacks, it's law and order. When blacks kill whites, we call the Marines and the Air Force and every other person we can have. And you know, so it's what, for instance, one of the things that they point out, say there's black on black violence in South Africa. Hell, if blacks wanted to kill other blacks, there's 22 million of us. We could really have a feast, you know? And you know, the point is that yes, there is black on black violence. There's necklacing. I'm not here to condone any violence. But if you calculate the number of people, if you want to be technical, calculate the number of people who have died on black violence in the last 2 years, and calculate the number of people who have died as a result of white on black violence, the numbers just don't even compare. I mean, there's less than 100 people who have died on black violence. And according to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others, they have calculated over 2,000 people who have died on white on black violence. But what we hope with divestment is we want to put it simplistically, we want to cut off the four pillars of apartheid. Oil, we want to cut off the computer sector, we want to cut off the automotive sector, we want to cut off money. South Africa relies on billions of dollars that come from our pension funds that go towards making loans to South Africa. And we are saying that if you cut off money, if you make it impossible for this government to exist, then they are forced to talk to their fellow black and white South Africans about a new country. And we recognize that if you do that, it will cause pain, but the pain of apartheid is more crippling than the pain of saying we might lose jobs. And anyway, you know, I always like when people talk about jobs. Have you ever wondered, and this is, you always ask questions, have you ever wondered why you've never read of the unemployment statistics in South Africa? Does anybody ever remember? It is illegal by law in South Africa to keep black unemployment statistics. It is illegal. And you go read anything, forget what I'm telling you. Go back to your town, go to the library, try and find unemployment statistics. It is illegal to keep them. Because they know if they keep them, And, you know, it's millions of people who are unemployed. And, you know, so that when they come to you and say people will lose jobs, you then feel guilty and say, oh, maybe we should do something, people might lose jobs. But it's because it's just reached a point where it's illegal. And, you know, they no longer keep it. So what we are trying to do, we want to make it impossible for this government to operate, and that's when we cut money, we cut off technology. And, you know, yes?
Are there other countries in the world that are also significant in giving capital to South Africa?
Oh, yes. Margaret Thatcher, the British and the Germans. But you know what's interesting? The divestment movement, England, for instance, the City of London, and I think Leeds is another one, Sheffield might be another city, have divested in spite of Margaret Thatcher and the British government. And you know, the Scandinavian countries, of course, were way ahead of everybody. And the French have a nice policy where they say they can no longer allow any more investments, but they're still trying to get them to cut those that are there. The reason we do that is because one of the criticisms is people say, if we Americans pull out, then, you know, those awful Japanese are going to go in and, you know, the Germans are going to go in. Bishop Tutu said, and he said, I know this sounds horrible coming from a bishop. He said, it's like somebody coming to you and saying, Bishop, let me rape your wife, because if I don't, someone out there will do it. And, you know, and you know, it's the point he was trying to make is that what we are trying to say is that it's okay if we exploit you. Because if we don't, somebody else will do it. The Japanese, when I was in Hawaii recently, there's a big campaign now in Japan to try and denounce the fact that they are given this special honorary white status. And, you know, and so the Japanese have a problem for them, which we are fighting to apply pressure. They operate like McDonald's. They use the franchise system. In other words, there is no Toyota Japan does not open shop in South Africa. They sell their franchise to Brazil or to Germany, and somebody there takes it to South Africa, then it becomes Toyota. So that's what they do. Maybe one more before we go. Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your own life, how long they kept you in jail, and if they let you live with your wife there?
Oh, no. Well, when we went to court, we lost, and then they said, well, of course, they charged my wife. They didn't charge me because it was easy for her to be victimized and under these laws. At the end of the trial, the judge said, you have two choices. She can go to jail for 90 days, and, you know, and afterwards be expelled. Now, she came from an area which was about 400 or 500 miles from where we live, or we were given the alternative that she accept internal exile and be at this place 500 miles away. We were not allowed to be together unless we apply in advance and give them reasons why we wanted to be together. And one thing that happened, we then found a way to come. You know, it's very interesting. One thing about this country you learn very quickly coming from is how people try to be very law-abiding, and I think they do it well to a large extent in this country. In South Africa, you learn from a child not to be law-abiding. I mean, it's nothing to break the law because we don't pay any attention. So in South Africa, you spend more time trying to figure out how do I break this law to survive, and you know, than worrying about, you know, what how can I live up to that law. We found another way, and we ended up living together. And on May 8, 1977, when my son was 4 years old, we threw a birthday party. We made one mistake. We invited little four-year-old who were kids or friends of ours were in jail. They came that night, they raided the house, and you know, and they couldn't find anything wrong. They turned around and took all these toys, these four-year-old kids had received, piled them in front of him. I mean, they have everybody, all of us in the house, my parents and everybody, and they started breaking the toys with their boots. And this four-year-old turned around to me and says, Daddy, why didn't you invite them to the party? Because he thought if we'd invite them to the party, they wouldn't have broken toys. But, you know, one of the things that made my father equal to other fathers, and, you know, in this country would be if your father didn't have a car and you live in a town where you need a car to go to the store, you'd sort of feel like unequal to your friends. But the equalizing thing when I grew up was a bicycle. You know, if your father didn't have a bicycle, you were poor. You know, you could be running around, you know, with torn clothes, but if your father has a bicycle, you are rich. You see? And so my father had a bicycle. And, you know, he used to have a carriage and put my brother in front, put another one on the frame, put two on the back, and cycle to church. And, you know, other kids were lucky they had cars, but we didn't care. Yeah, they arrived earlier than us, but we also arrived, my father's bicycle. And, you know, so when my son was 4 years old, I did what, you know, as a father, and bought him a bicycle. And, you know, so we had this situation where they're trying to bend the horns of this bicycle. So my wife screams and tries to go and save this bicycle. They picked her up, threw her against the wall. She was 3 months pregnant. She had a miscarriage right there and there. We took her to Baragwanath Hospital. The doctor took one look at her before wheeling her into surgery and said, "Nurse, whoever did this, call the police." And, you know, so she gets wheeled in. The nurse asked me, "Who did this?" "It's the police." And the nurse said, "Oh, we get cases like that. I'm sorry about it." And this doctor, who was incensed going into surgery, comes out and he gets told that it's the police. And he turns around to me and says, "Listen, I'm sorry, it's the police. Don't mention my name. I don't want to get into trouble." The reason I say that is simply to say to you, that's how chilling the system can be. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are, but it's a very, very chilling system. And because it's so chilling, it makes people tend to swallow what they're about. I was telling people earlier on in the Bible study that, you know, the only way I could find out what my father was thinking was to listen to him pray. Because the safest moment was during prayer. And, you know, and you know, we never sat down, my father never sat down and said, "Son, we are suffering." I understand, I'm a father now. You never sit down with your son and say, "Son, I'm really being torn apart." It's dehumanizing as a parent. But if you wanted to know what was going through my father, you had to listen to him pray. I never forget the first time the police came to raid me. I'd written a story they didn't like, so they came to raid me. And if you get raided by the South African police, it's incredible. I mean, they come in God knows how many cars. They surround the house and they bang on the windows, they climb on the roof. Well, we live in Everton, we lived on corrugated iron, you know, what do you call it, corrugated iron in this country, you know, zinc. And they bang around and, you know, we open the house. And my mother is looking at me and I'm trying to look away at my father. And, you know, they don't have to show a warrant because they are the law. And, you know, they come in and they rip the whole house apart and they don't tell you what they're looking for and they leave. And the house is a mess. And it was such a shock. We've just very quietly, without saying, "My God," they left or anything, without any one of us saying a word, just picked up pieces and put them wherever they were and went to sleep quietly. We never talked about it again. They came again. My mother, who was very feisty, decided, "Hell, enough is enough." And, you know, she was about 5'5", and they come to my home. So we use candles for lighting. And, you know, so they come into their house, and they take the candles, and they start. And my mother was 5 foot. The cops are like, you know, linebackers in San Francisco, you know, 49ers, you know, 6'6", 250 pounds. And my mother goes behind them, and she's blowing off the candle. She says, "Buy your own candles next time you come to my house." And these policemen are towering over and wondering, "What's wrong with this woman?" But, you know, those of you who saw the play Fences, I wept when I saw that play in Broadway. I mean, it's about a play to show you the connection between. You are never going to understand what's happening in South Africa unless you begin to understand what's happening to black people here. This is what the whole week is about. You have to get their feelings here, then you can transfer them that way. Because when I saw the play Fences, which ended up with James L. Jones building a fence, I remembered my father coming home. If you've seen pictures of Soweto, they have these 15-foot fences around homes. I came home, my father was putting up this fence around our house. And I said to him, why are you putting up the fence? He says, "Oh, we've been losing things, and you know, there's an old Zulu tradition, you just avoid things as much as you can, don't say anything." And so he's putting this fence around the house. And you know why? Because he wanted to put a lock at the gate so that at least we can keep the police out or delay them enough. And when they came, they jumped through the fence, of course, and came in and wrecked the house. When they wanted to leave, they turned around to him and said, "Old man, open up the gate." And my father said, "I have to wake up and go to work soon, so you go out the way you came in. I'm sorry to keep you long. I hear the bell telling us. We will be here, and there'll be more at the session.